Mr. LaGorie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court. May it please the Court. I'm just going to get right into why I believe we were brought before this high court today, and that's the violation of the Uniform District Court Rule Section 6-1526, stating specifically that the moving party on a motion for summary judgment, as here the appellee did, must provide an evidence index and support listing the evidence to be offered in support of the motion in an annotated statement of undisputed facts, setting forth concise number paragraphs reciting each proposed material fact as to which the moving party contends there is no genuine issue of dispute, annotated by pinpoint citation to the supporting evidence in the evidence index in support. Failure to submit such a statement may constitute a grounds for denial of the motion.
Does it say may constitute or shall constitute?
It says may.
What does that suggest?
Well, it suggests that, just as it says, may. And that's why I'm taking the position that we're taking, where it says must. You must provide this. And it wasn't provided. And below...
How do you get from may to must?
The rule actually says the moving party must simultaneously file with the clerk and serve on the party.
I'm talking about may in the remedy section. Failure to submit such a statement may constitute grounds for denial of the motion.
I think the may position in this indicates specifically under the rule that this may be a remedy. If this isn't the remedy, then we go directly to subsection D, where the assigned judge is expected to schedule deadlines for compliance with this rule, and that wasn't done here either. Did you ask? Yes, I objected to it very clearly at the time of trial, said that this was never provided, it must be provided.
You mean at the time of the hearing?
At the time of the hearing, yes, Your Honor.
We didn't have a trial, right?
You're correct, thank you. But yes, I did object to it specifically, pointed out the exact rule. The judge's response at that time was, we're here. I give leniency to the parties to make argument, and that was essentially it. My understanding of this rule is specifically, just as the rule states, it ensures a fair opportunity to all parties to present their evidence. And in this case, the must provision was not followed. So what I'm asking is this rule in force and effect, or is it not? And that's what I asked the district court judge on that day. What's the point of having a rule if we're not going to follow it? And that wasn't addressed. That wasn't answered. The only response was, we're here, we're going to hear it. It put my client at an extreme disadvantage because the burden shifted exactly to my client. It even says that in the ruling that my client wasn't able to meet the burden of proof to unprove the motion for summary judgment, even though my client was not the moving party in the action. But from point A, from the very start of that hearing at that time, we were treated as if we were the moving party. We had the burden to prove that the summary judgment should not be put in effect, something that the appellee was required to do, that my client was required to do and complied with, which the trial court specifically said in his ruling, or on the bench that day, he said, I see you followed the rule. I thank you for doing that. It makes it clear and precise what you're presenting today. Well, it makes it just as unclear and unprecise what we're attempting to dispute on that day when the moving party doesn't follow the rule. And that's what occurred here. It's very difficult to explain to your clients why, when we are told there's a must provision that must be followed and we follow it, that we'd be put at a disadvantage for doing so. And that's exactly what occurred. And the rule is very clear. It says it must be followed. If it's not followed, it says that the assigned judge is expected to schedule deadlines for compliance with the rule. It's not, let's just have a hearing, which occurred here because it was a convenient on that day, it was, this needs to be rescheduled so compliance can be had. That never occurred.
What impact does, if any, does Kimberly's brief have in compliance with the rule?
I don't think it has any impact in compliance with the rule, because specifically the attorney for the appellee stated he did not comply with the rule. I think at that point then the only argument is we did submit a brief, but the brief isn't consistent with the requirement of the
Kimberly
rule.
Kimberly contends the brief was consistent, so I'm just asking how.
But it's not.
Okay.
I mean, it's not an annotated statement of disputed facts. It's their argument on very separate issues. Essentially, they're not essentially talking about the main issue of what was, I believe, the purpose of the will contest, which was the ambiguity of the document. They specifically swayed to testamentary capacity and tried to argue that position more so.
Where, which brings me to a question which I may later address to your opponent, but I want to give you a chance to answer it as well. Where in the Bill of Exceptions would I find the will or the affidavits that your opponent relies on?
You won't.
They're not in there?
They're not in there, no.
Is that a problem?
I believe it's a problem, but again, we weren't the moving party. They were. They presented the evidence such as they did, and it's not in there. I mean, they didn't have any exhibits marked. They just said they were offering from the record at that point in time. And Your Honors, we're not hanging our hat specifically on the rule violation. If we do look at the will, which I agree, the will was not presented as evidence that day. If we do look at the will specifically states right in it that the daughter would receive the residue and remainder. And the argument that the appellee presents is that the daughter receives the entire estate. And to read the will, which essentially is what happened to my client, he comes to me and he says, this will says residue and remainder. It doesn't say anywhere entire estate, and it doesn't. And appellee's position is, well, it's the entire estate.
How do you reconcile your position with the statute, section 30-2342?
That position takes for granted that the testator's intent is clear. The will very specifically shows that the testator's intent was only to pass the residue and remainder. And that's specifically shown in Exhibit 2, which the drafter of the will is the same drafter of a will that was drafted 7 months later that shows specifically the entire estate being transferred, and shows specifically that one party will not take in the entire will. That language was left out of this will for a particular purpose. That language is not here. It would have been here. If the intent by the testator was to transfer the entire estate or all the estate, that language is easy to put in the will. It was never there.
But none of this is in the record.
The will's not in the record.
Your opponent will say it's in the transcript.
He'll say it's
in the transcript. But it's not in the Bill of Exceptions, right?
It's not in the Bill of Exceptions.
Okay.
The conflicting will is in the Bill of Exceptions under Exhibit 2. I would like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Mr. Smith, you probably could see the question coming.
I could.
Where do I find the will or your affidavits in the Bill of Exceptions?
Okay. May it please the Court. My name is Rick Smith. I represent the appellee, Kim Bowling. To answer your question, Justice, my position is that the will and the affidavits were offered and received at the hearing on our motion for summary judgment.
But they're not in the Bill of Exceptions.
The court did not require us to mark them separately before considering them, but he did hear, the district judge did hear objections to their receipt, and he received them.
Haven't we said literally hundreds of times the only way to bring evidence before this court is in a Bill of Exceptions?
Yes, Your Honor, and to that I argue this. I don't believe that if it were error by the district court to not require me to make a better record, essentially, which is what you're saying, I believe that error is harmless because I don't think that whether I had marked those exhibits and offered them or whether the court considered them as part of the record, which is what the trial court did.
If we do what you're suggesting, aren't we abandoning the rule requiring people to include evidence in the Bill of Exceptions? Won't that become the default and we'll just essentially have to look to the transcript and the Bill of Exceptions to find evidence in the future?
I think the difference here, Your Honor, is that we didn't just rely merely on the pleadings and say we'll submit it. We specifically offered those parts of the transcript. The only difference is that they weren't marked.
And whose obligation is it to make the record regarding evidence into a Bill of Exception?
That'd be the attorney's. That would be my obligation, Your Honor.
Okay.
And obviously if this court sends it back and makes me make a better record, I understand that.
Okay. So let's put that aside for the moment and turn to what you want to talk about.
Okay. Well, while we're talking about rules, let's talk about 6-15-26, the rule regarding motions for summary judgment. My position is I acknowledge that strict compliance with the form of that rule was not done simultaneous to the filing of my motion. However, I think the motion itself containing the and having incorporated therein the affidavits that we eventually submitted complies in substance to that rule. I think that the subsequent filing of the brief complies in substance to the other part of that rule, even though those two pleadings were not captioned as the rule requires them to be captioned.
Why do you suppose that the rule was drafted to require a separate statement as opposed to setting something in a brief?
I think that generally cases that come before the district courts on summary judgment are more complicated than this, and the evidence is a little more difficult to navigate than 4 pages of affidavit and a 2-page will. I think it's less useful. The rule itself clearly makes it useful for the trial court to decipher both parties' evidence. The moving party is saying, here's exactly where to find everything that I have. Everything that I plan on presenting to this court is right here. I believe that I accomplished that in our motion for summary judgment and the subsequent brief, directing the trial court specifically to the specific areas of our affidavits and of the will itself. This one wasn't a particularly fact-intensive case. Now, the rule itself, while I didn't specifically comply with it, I don't believe that it was error for the court to take up the case. For one thing, the rule itself allows the trial court to extend those deadlines. So even if those aren't filed simultaneously with the motion itself, the trial court can say you have more time to do that. The trial court didn't hear because the appellant didn't request more time. He didn't request an extension of those deadlines. He simply said, let's stop, let's put the brakes on here. We can't go forward. He didn't request a continuance or anything to that effect. And the fact that
why would he request a continuance?
Well, if his whole argument is that the rules weren't being complied with, he didn't ask the court to then comply with the rule. He didn't ask for the court to take the next step that the rule allows for. My argument is that by not taking that next step explicitly, the court is implicitly making that next step and saying, this thing that should have been filed simultaneously with your motion is I'm now accepting, even though you served it on opposing counsel after your motion was filed, but before the hearing on the motion for summary judgment. In addition, with respect to the court not requiring me to specifically comply with those rules. I would ask this court to read together Nebraska Revised Statute 25801.01, which directs this court to promulgate those rules, and states that all pleadings shall be construed as to do substantial justice. I would ask you to read that with Rule 6-1101 of the rules themselves.
Is this a pleading?
The motion for summary judgment is a pleading. And
isn't it a motion?
I thought
the pleadings were complaints, answers, and replies. Counterclaims, cross-claims.
Okay. Well, then I'll ask you to look at Rule 6-1101, which says that these rules shall be construed and administered to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action. Now, this particular will contest isn't before this court because this testator had questionable testamentary capacity. It's not because there's any evidence that he had any sort of propensity to be easily influenced or to be subject to undue influence by another party, or that such undue influence was exerted. It's merely that the appellant was unhappy because his dad wrote him out of his will and gave everything to his sister. I don't think that, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on testamentary capacity, execution, or undue influence, because I think those are pretty clear if this court determines that it will look to the evidence that the appellee offered at trial, or excuse me, at the motion for summary judgment, which the court received in the form of the will itself, and the two affidavits that were attached to our motion. I think that's the question. I think it's pretty clear. Anything beyond that, there's not much to this. This is a pretty straightforward will contest where the will itself is about as clear and unambiguous as a will can get. It says, I leave the rest, residue, and remainder to my daughter. I'm not unmindful of my son. I leave him nothing.
Doesn't it presume that there was another gift made?
I don't think so. I think those are terms of art that Mr. Morrissey used in drafting that will. Rest, residue, and remainder, I think, is that sort of general residuary clause that is referred to in the statute, saying that general residuary clause disposes of everything.
Could it refer to a non-probate asset?
Well, and if it does, then I don't know that affects the probate. I think that the will itself, if there's some non-probate asset that was given during life...
Something that by operation of law could devolve
absolutely,
to somebody.
Right. For a life estate, for example, would not be included, but it wouldn't be affected by the will anyway. Basically, everything that passes under his will passes to Kimberly Bowling, and nothing that passes under the will passes to Robert Bowling. Did that answer your question?
I think so.
Okay. With regards to the shifting of the burden to the appellant, I think that, again, is going to hinge on the same question as to whether the court properly considered the affidavits and the will in making its decision. I'm asking that this court affirm the decision of the district court, and I thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
48 seconds,
Mr. Liguori.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I think that's a very appropriate question where the court asked, essentially, why would we ask for a continuance? They didn't follow the rule. You must follow the rule. Every burden was placed on my client, a non-moving party. From the point we walked in that courtroom, the burden was on us to disprove a position that we weren't supposed to prove in the first place. And when they would not file the undisputed facts, there was a reason for it, because they couldn't. And a brief is not undisputed facts, and it doesn't directly annotate the undisputed fact. A brief is an argument arguing your position, which that's what they did. But they did not show undisputed facts because they couldn't. And that's why that's not brought before them. And in a point that where he says the will is clear and concise, it's not as clear and concise as MUD, because they say the will transfers the entire estate. But that does not consider the actual language of the will, which says that it transfers the leftovers, the residue and remainder. So it's very difficult in this case to say when the court says must, when the rule says must, that doesn't apply. But then later where they say, well, where this says residue and remainder, we're not going to consider that either. We're just going to draw that language out and not consider it. And we're going to put the burden on the non-moving party to show us how it should. And we met that burden, but we didn't have to, and there was no other evidence presented. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is Lanham versus BNSF Railway Company.